You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 1980 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the fifth class in a series given by Brother Jim Millay on the subject, What Manner of Persons Ought Ye to Be?
For both my wife and myself, how much we have enjoyed this opportunity to be here at the Western Bible School and to meet so many of you, to have a feeling of warmness. There's a very nice feeling of fellowship here at this school, and we really have enjoyed it. And we'll take many fond memories back east with us when we go. We've enjoyed our visit here. Today, as we consider once again some final thoughts on our subject, what manner of persons ought we to be, I would like to, because of time and because we have actually had to skip over some of the notes that I had, but I would like to center my thoughts today perhaps a little more on this generation and some of the things that we are facing in this generation, recognizing that there are some situations that we may not be able to do much about. But there are quite a few things said about this generation, and I think it concerns us to be aware of these things so that we can effectively encounter them and stand against them to be the type of persons that we ought to be. We're all familiar with these words, I'm sure, from the 17th chapter of Luke, speaking about the conditions in the last days. Luke 17, starting in verse 26. And as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be also in the days of the Son of Man. They did eat, they drank, they married wives, they were given in marriage until the day that Noah entered into the ark, and the flood came and destroyed them all. Likewise also as it was in the days of Lot, they did eat, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they builded. But the same day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. Even thus shall it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed. The events that are mentioned here as being of concern, of being depictive of the type of life that was being led in the days of Noah, if you look at these words, it doesn't really mention a whole lot about gross evil and wickedness and perverseness. It talks about some of the things that are so much a part of everyday life. It talks about eating and drinking and marrying wives. It talks about buying and selling and planting and building. It talks about the common occurrences that everyone is involved in, whether they are wicked or righteous. It talks about the normal activities of life. And these are the things that the people were doing in the days of Noah and in the days of Lot. These were the main concerns, that they were doing these things unto themselves without any consideration and thought for God. They were too involved in eating and drinking and marrying wives and buying and selling and planting, building, and all of the other things that are so much a part of life, that they knew not when the destruction came upon them. And even thus shall it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed. Now there is a principle in this, is something that I would like to leave with you when we consider what manner of persons we ought to be and what we should be involved in and what we should be doing. I'd like to connect this with some thoughts from 1 Corinthians in the 10th chapter of 1 Corinthians, starting in verse 21. Ye cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of devils. Ye cannot be partakers of the Lord's table and of the table of devils. Do we provoke the Lord to jealousy? Are we stronger than he? all things are lawful for me, but all things are not expedient. All things are lawful for me, but all things edify not. These words in the 23rd verse, I think, are some very, very important words for us to consider when we think about what manner of people we ought to be and what we should be doing. And the way that I relate this to the things that they were doing in the days of Lot and in the days of Noah is that they were doing all things. They were eating and drinking and marrying wives. They were buying and selling and planting and building. All of the things that they were doing, in effect, were lawful for them. There was nothing wrong with eating and drinking. There's nothing wrong with marrying. There's nothing wrong with buying and selling and planting and building. But when you put all things together, they multiply against you. And all things are lawful, but all things are not expedient. So whether or not something is lawful and legal for a servant of God to be involved in isn't necessarily the point. The point is whether or not these things are going to be expedient for us to be involved in, and whether or not collectively they could multiply so that all things, in effect, are too much for us to be doing, even though they're legal. They're too much for us to be doing so that we no longer have any time to serve God, and we are caught in a situation as they were in the days of Noah and in the days of Lot, where they were doing all things, and yet they were doing them in such a way that they had no longer any time or any consideration for the service of God, and the flood came and swept them all away. When we get ourselves involved in too many of the normal activities of everyday life, we get ourselves into a situation such as is described in the 14th chapter of Luke. And these words, I think, here in the 14th chapter of Luke are very appropriate for our consideration, because they have to do with our calling to a wedding feast. In Luke 14, starting in verse 16, "Then said he unto him, A certain man made a great supper and bade many, and sent his servant at supper time to say to them that were bidden, Come, for all things are now ready. And they all with one consent began to make excuse." They began to make excuse. "The first said unto him, I have bought a piece of ground, and I must needs go and see it. I pray thee, have me excused." Very reasonable. He had bought a piece of ground. It was important to him at that particular time, and he needed to be excused. "And another said, I have bought 5 yoke of oxen, and I go to prove them. I pray thee, have me excused. And another said, I have married a wife, and therefore I cannot come." The Lord was angry with these servants because the things of this present life, the things that were lawful, the things that were okay for them to be doing, were not expedient at that particular moment. It should have been more important for them to have found time to consider the invitation of the Master to come to the wedding feast. And yet, these things were so important, these simple things of everyday life, that they became excuses and they interfered with their service and their love for their Master. We can become prisoners, in effect, prisoners of trivial, prisoners of all of the things that surround us in this life, all of the very simple, honest, legal sorts of things. And yet, if we put too many of them into our lives, they imprison us. We become trapped. And we get into a situation where, if we really wanted to consider it, we do the things that we want to do. And when we make an excuse, when we say, I can't come, it's because there's something at that particular time that we want to do more than whatever it may be that represents our service to God at that particular point. So we may seem to be in a situation where there are just too many things in our life at this particular moment, and they're all crowding in on us, and it doesn't seem as though we have time to do everything that we want to do in our service to God. But if these things are crowding in on us and imprisoning us, it's because we have voluntarily formed these bars around us. It's because we have willingly made ourselves prisoners of all of these activities. And when the choice comes to be made, we find that we choose at that particular point in time the thing that we want to do the most. We always find time for the thing that we really love doing. We always find time for it. And hopefully, the thing that we will love to be doing is doing our service to God. And we'll always find time for that, no matter what else there may be around us that's pulling us in so many different directions. I was thankful for the hymn that was sung this morning. Totally coincidental. The last hymn that we sang, Soldiers of Christ, because it fits in very nicely with some of my thoughts from 2 Timothy, the second chapter, where we are reminded that we are, in effect, soldiers. 2 Timothy, the second chapter, starting in the first verse, Thou therefore, my son, be strong in the grace that is in Christ Jesus, and the things that thou hast heard of me among many witnesses, the same commit to faithful men who shall be able to teach others also. Thou therefore endure hardness as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. No man that warreth entangleth himself with the affairs of this life, that he may please him who hath chosen him to be a soldier. No man that warreth entangleth himself with the affairs of this life, that he may please him who hath chosen him to be a soldier. We have been chosen to be soldiers. And if we wish to please our commander-in-chief, then we should not entangle ourselves with the affairs of this life. It's interesting that when the children of Israel were choosing soldiers, they received instructions that was very much along this line in the 20th chapter of Deuteronomy. When thou goest out to battle against thine enemies and seest horses and chariots and a people more than thou, be not afraid of them, for the Lord thy God is with thee, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. And it shall be when ye are come nigh unto the battle that the priest shall approach and speak unto the people and shall say unto them, Hear, O Israel, ye approach this day unto battle against your enemies. Let not your hearts faint, fear not, and do not tremble, neither be ye terrified because of them. For the Lord your God is he that goeth with you to fight for you against your enemies to save you. And the officers shall speak unto the people, saying, What man is there that hath bought a new house and hath not dedicated it? Let him go and return to his house, lest he die in the battle, and another man dedicate it. And what man is he that hath planted the vineyard and hath not eaten of it? Let him also go and return unto his house, lest he die in the battle, and another man eat of it. And what man is there that hath betrothed the wife, and hath not taken her? Let him go and return unto his house, lest he die in the battle, and another man take her. And the officers shall speak further unto the people, and they shall say, What man is there that is fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go and return unto his house, lest his brethren's heart faint as well as his heart. It seems to me that the recognition is made here that it was very important in the selection of soldiers for the battle that anyone who was entangled with the affairs of this life at that particular point in time should be left behind, whether it was because he had just bought a new house and his mind was on that, whether he had planted the vineyard and he was concerned more with that vineyard than he was with the battle, or whether he had betrothed the wife and had not taken her. Whatever it was in the normal activities of life that were entangling those individuals, they were not fit to be called as soldiers at that particular time. And even though some had been encouraged as he began that they should not have faint hearts, there still were those who, after being given a choice, their hearts were faint, and they also were not allowed to go to battle, lest their fears would be transmitted to their brethren, and it would affect the whole action that they were undertaking. So we see this example, where if we are called to be soldiers of Christ, it's very important, if we're going to effectively perform that mission, that we not be over-entangled with the things of life, the things that are lawful, that are not expedient, the things that are all things put together that multiply against us sometimes and imprison us and keep us from being able to effectively perform the service that we have as soldiers in Christ. So to be good soldiers, let's realize that it isn't always the evil. It isn't the outright sin. It isn't the wickedness that sometimes takes its toll on us. It's the normal activities of life, the things that we do every day, the things that are completely legal, completely lawful, honest, upright, and yet too often, too many of these things can entrap us and prevent us from performing our love to our master. When we consider the days of Noah, and in particular the days of Lot, quite often you see a picture or a movie about those times, and it's depicted as gross wickedness. People are painted up with all kinds of wild makeup. They're dancing in the streets, and they're just completely lewd, and their behavior is depicted as being very, very bad. Well, I'm not sure that it was quite that way, even though obviously in the account of their handling of Lot at that particular time and the two angels that came to visit Lot, there is a definite sense of wickedness there in that particular account. But there is a verse in Ezekiel that makes me think that some of the wickedness of Sodom, or perhaps a good deal of it, was not as outright wicked as we might normally be shown that it is. In Ezekiel 16 and verse 49, "Behold, this was the iniquity of thy sister Sodom, pride, fullness of bread, and the abundance of idleness was in her and in her daughters, neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor and the needy, and they were haughty and committed abomination before me, therefore I took them away as I saw good." The specific things that are mentioned here are pride, fullness of bread, and the abundance of idleness, and not strengthening the hand of the poor and the needy. These are things that we accept as a way of life in this great country that we live in. There's prosperity, there's fullness of bread, there's plenty of time for idleness. Pride, fullness of bread, and the abundance of idleness was the iniquity of Sodom. And perhaps in God's eyes, pride, fullness of bread, and the abundance of idleness is the iniquity of the United States of America. Sometimes, again, I think as we're defining wickedness, we tend to go overboard. And not to say that there isn't plenty of gross wickedness around us. But there's a verse in Malachi that, to me, defines wickedness in perhaps a way that it hits a little bit closer to home. Malachi, the third chapter, and I would like to look first of all at verse 16 and 17, because these two verses are very beautiful verses, and they remind us of what we're doing here this week and how we have come together about the name of God and to read His Word. Then they that feared the Lord spake often one to another. And the Lord hearkened and heard it, and a book of remembrance was written before Him for them that feared the Lord and thought upon His name. And they shall be mine, saith the Lord of hosts, in that day when I make up my jewels, and I will spare them as a man spareth his own son that serveth him. Beautiful thoughts to realize that if we truly fear the Lord and speak often one to another and think upon His name, that we have the hope of being a part of those jewels that are made up and being spared. Verse 18, then shall ye return and discern between the righteous and the wicked, between him that serveth God and him that serveth him not. Very, very simple definition. Should there be any difficulty in discerning between the righteous and the wicked? Apparently, there is difficulty in discerning between the righteous and the wicked. But the definition that's given here is very clear. The righteous serve God, and the wicked serve Him not. So no matter how good and kind and honorable people may be, man that is in honor and understandeth not is like the beast that perish. And no matter how gentle and better living sometimes our neighbors around us may be than we are, God defines the righteous as those that serve God, and the wicked as those that serve Him not. Thinking still a little bit more about the days of Lot, I like the story of Lot because, to me, Lot represents the typical average Christadelphian in many ways. You recall when Lot and Abraham first came near the land of promise, and they lifted up their eyes and looked at the land, and Lot chose the best of the land. He wasn't concerned with whether or not an elder should have had first choice. He, who was the nephew, when given an opportunity, took the best of the land. And at that time, the land in and around Sodom and Gomorrah was a beautiful land. And he chose that land. He chose the best of the land. He was concerned first and foremost with his material well-being, with having good pastures for his flocks. And so he took that land, and he pitched his tent towards Sodom. He wasn't concerned about what the people were in Sodom and whether they were servants of God or not. He pitched his tent towards Sodom because he felt that being nearer to the city, he had a better opportunity to be secure. He found his security in the things of man, not in God. Sooner or later, as we read the account, we find that not only did he pitch his tent towards Sodom, but he actually dwelt in the gate of the city. Because gradually he was there, he became involved. He became a part of their lifestyle and their activity. And maybe in some ways we can identify with Lot because we have the same needs that he did. We have our concerns about our occupations, about our ability to feed our family, about the green pastures and about security. And so we can identify with Lot. Hopefully we can carry that identification with Lot a little further also. Let's look at, in 2 Peter, the second chapter of 2 Peter. 2 Peter in the second chapter, verse 6. and turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned them with an overthrow, making them an example unto those that after should live ungodly, and delivered just Lot, vexed with the filthy conversation of the wicked. For that righteous man, dwelling among them, and seeing and hearing, vexed his righteous soul from day to day with their unlawful deeds. The Lord knoweth how to deliver the godly out of temptations, and to reserve the unjust unto the day of judgment to be punished. So if we can identify with Lot, let's recognize that in all of his weaknesses, in all of his need to be near to the city, to have the greener pastures, to take the things that were important to the natural man, he still is identified as being a righteous man, a just man. For what reason? Because Lot was vexed with the filthy conversation of the wicked. He wasn't happy about his circumstances. He wasn't content to dwell there. He was trapped there. He had gradually gotten drawn into the city of Sodom, and he didn't really want to be there. And it bothered him. And every day he vexed his righteous soul from day to day with their unlawful deeds. It troubled him. It perplexed him. He wasn't content to be with it. He hadn't assimilated it into his behavior. He hadn't become to the point where he was apathetic about it, to the point where he no longer could look at what was going on around him and recognize it as wickedness, as recognize the fact that these people were just simply living their lives after their own lusts and not serving God. Lot was vexed with the filthy conversation of the wicked. And we're talking about what manner of persons we ought to be in all holy conversation and godliness. These people were living in what is described as filthy conversation. Totally the opposite. And if we're in the center of this same sort of thing today, then we ought to be vexed by it. There is a related account, I think, in Ezekiel again. And it's one that becomes a little sobering, I think, when we talk about some of the activities of this present world, and we discuss things like TV and some of the other things that could be considered to be evil. Ezekiel in the 9th chapter and the 4th verse, "And the Lord said unto him, Go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, and set a mark upon the foreheads of the men that sigh and that cry for all of the abominations that be done in the midst thereof. And to the others he said in mine hearing, Go ye after him through the city and smite. Let not your eye spare, neither have ye pity. Slay utterly old and young, both maids and little children and women, but come not near any man upon whom is the mark, and begin at my sanctuary." 8th verse, there is a verse that relates very much to our day, and you've all read this verse. "I tell you that he will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man cometh, shall he find faith on the earth?" Shall he find faith on the earth? If we read the account that leads up to these words, we find that he tells us about a widow that lives in a city, and that this parable is spoken that men ought always to pray and not to faint, as we see in verse 1. "There was in a city a judge which feared not God, neither regarded man. And there was a widow in that city, and she came unto him, saying, Avenge me of mine adversary. And he would not for a while, but afterward he said within himself, Though I fear not God nor regard man, yet because this widow troubleth me, I will avenge her, lest by her continual coming she weary me. And the Lord said, hear what the unjust judge saith. And shall not God avenge his own elect, which cry day and night unto him, though he bear long with them? I tell you that he will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man cometh, shall he find faith on the earth? The point being that, yes, God will avenge his own elect that are crying day and night unto him, that are sighing and crying unto him, that are really recognizing the situation that are in, that are really concerned about something being done about it, that are really looking for a change to come, that are looking for the kingdom of God. But shall he find this kind of faith when he comes? Shall he find this kind of sincere desire, this sort of sighing and crying? I wish I could say that I feel that I am worthy to fit into this, but I'm not. I can't say to you that I sigh and cry, that I find the time many times to be concerned. There are so many things that crowd in on me, like every one of us, that interfere, and that somehow life seems to be okay at some times as it is. And yet it shouldn't be. We should recognize that it isn't okay the way it is, that we really have something better and more wonderful and greater that's coming. And we shouldn't be satisfied with what we have. We shouldn't be accepting it. We should be praying to God for deliverance from this condition. And we should be doing it continually so that he would find this kind of faith on the earth when he comes. Sometimes you get to wondering about the Lord's coming and whether or not there will be faithful on the earth. And certainly it's a very difficult thing to think about, because none of us want to consider that there won't be any faithful. None of us want to feel that the Lord will not save many of us in his kingdom. The 25th chapter of Matthew is one that sometimes we take some encouragement from, because it talks about the 10 virgins. And it says that 5 of them were wise and 5 of them were foolish. And we know the story, how some of them took oil in their vessels with their lamps, but others let the lamps go out and they had no oil. And when the cry came, they tried to ask the wise virgins for their oil, and it was too late. And we could take comfort in saying, well, maybe that's an indication that at least 50% of those that are here when the bridegroom calls would be saved. There is one phrase in there that bothers me about that approach in the 4th verse of the 25th chapter of Matthew. While the bridegroom tarried, they all slumbered and slept. Is he talking here about a group of virgins that represent those who are the virgins in the last days? Or is he talking about a group at some point in history where there may have been 50%? And yet now all of those that are involved are slumbering and sleeping, waiting for the resurrection. It's hard sometimes to find a verse that speaks really good about the servants of God at the time of the Lord's return. Look at Matthew 24. Matthew 24, verse 44. Therefore be ye also ready, for in such an hour as ye think not, the Son of Man cometh. Who then is a faithful and wise servant whom his Lord hath made ruler over his household to give them meat in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his Lord, when he cometh, shall find so doing. There will be some when he comes who he will find so doing. And verily I say unto you that he shall make him ruler over all his goods. But, and if that evil servant shall say in his heart, My Lord delayeth his coming, and shall begin to smite his fellow servants and to eat and drink with the drunken, the Lord of that servant shall come in a day when he looketh not for him, and in an hour that he is not aware of, and shall cut him asunder and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites. There shall be a weeping and gnashing of teeth. It concerns me sometimes when I look at these words in verse 49, and shall begin to smite his fellow servants and to eat and drink with the drunken. Do we ever perhaps have more difficulties getting along with our brothers and sisters than we do with those around us in the world? Do we find sometimes that we have a better relationship with the drunken, that we can eat and drink with them and have an enjoyable social evening? And yet, sometimes with our brothers and sisters, we end up in controversy and we beat our fellow servants. I often wonder if some of these words don't define some of the conditions that unfortunately develop between brethren. 2 Timothy, the third chapter. There are more words that speak about this generation. And again, they're not words that are flattering. 2 Timothy 3, verses 1 through 5, where it speaks about the perilous times that would come, men being lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, without natural affection, truce-breakers, false accusers, incontinent, fierce, despisers of those that are good, traitors, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasures, more than lovers of God. A lot of description there of the kind of problems that would be seen in the last days. And I think the one that concerns me the most there is the one in verse 4 that speaks of being lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God. Sometimes I feel that we fit into that, where we become lovers of pleasure. It's difficult to consider some of these thoughts, but at least it is comforting to recognize that in 1 Thessalonians, in the 4th chapter, it does speak about those that will be alive and remain under the coming of the Lord. And we certainly want to be among those that recognize the conditions that we encounter, that realize that in some ways the odds are against us because the spoken word or the written word has indicated that this generation would have some problems, but that there will be still those who are spoken of who are alive and remain to the coming of the Lord, who will not prevent them which are asleep. And it is our hope in this class that we can recognize the conditions that we are faced with, and we can be concerned about what manner of persons that we ought to be, and that in being so concerned that we can collectively help each other, that we can struggle together, that we can grow together, so that we will be among those who are alive and who remain unto the coming of the Lord, that we might all together, if possible, be found worthy in his kingdom. Speaking in closing, I think, and considering a little bit about the remarks that have been spoken of this week about, Behold, I come quickly, and my reward is with me, I would like to just close my remarks with a few words from a hymn, and I'm not sure what the number is in the new book, but it's a verse which has these words in it, Who shall receive the pebble, the raiment pure and white, the holy name of ale, the change to spirit light. He who has hands of cleanness, whose heart abides in truth, whose soul abhors to leanness, the vanities of youth. Thank you.